Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. There are a number of animal organizations that have a no-kill policy. Instead, they look for permanent homes for animals abandoned or brought in by owners who can no longer care for them. We know a number of our listeners are proud owners of rescue pets. But until that new forever home can be found, these dogs and cats and other animals need to be sheltered and fed and shown some love. And that stretches resources to the limit. Part of the solution is fostering or temporarily placing an animal with qualified people willing to open their homes to these creatures. Today, we start with a look at some of these fostering programs that extend help to a variety of animals. With us once again is Dr. Wayne Hunhausen. He's a veterinarian and animal behavior specialist who heads the Westwood Animal Hospital. Wayne, always nice to have you here.
Great.
Welcome.
To be here. Great to be here.
And also with us this morning is Kate Field. She's president and CEO of the Humane Society of Greater Kansas City. Kate, nice to have you too. Good morning.
Appreciate it, Steve. Thank you.
Well, Wayne, get us started here. Why are these fostering organizations so important?
Well, they're great for so many reasons. They're really great for the pets because in many of the shelter environments, that they're very stressful. They're noisy. There's a lot of activity going on. And for really sensitive pets especially, they can really regress socially. They can withdraw. Some of them develop compulsive stereotype behaviors where they circle or chew on their tails or their paws. So it's really good for them to be in a more of a normal environment. It helps prepare them for going into a new home, so it's an easier transition for them. And it's also good for the people that adopt, because if the pet's been in a foster home, maybe it's been in a foster home with another dog or another cat, that gives the potential adopting family a little more information about how that pet might fit into their home.
And so you wonder, where will we be without these kinds of organizations?
The people that volunteer their time are just absolutely wonderful. I mean, they're lifesavers for these pets, because if we didn't have organizations like this, we'd probably end up, we'd have more animals running the streets and just having a horrible quality of life, or they'd be euthanized.
Yeah. Well, Kate, your fostering program is for cats and dogs, but do you ever come across another animal that, you know, might need someone to take it in at least temporarily?
You know, we do focus on companion animals, cats and dogs. We have had the occasional turtle that have come across our door. So, you know, we do have a very caring staff that either will help us out and take them home and care for them, or find people that will help. But we do focus on the companion animal.
And what is the greatest demand? Is it dogs? Is it cats? Is it turtles? What is it, Kate?
It's both, really. And right now we're on the kind of the downward slide of kitten season. So we've got close to 100 cats and kittens in foster families right now.
100? Wow.
Got about 20 to 25 dogs in foster.
And when an animal is in a foster home, do you guys have the capability of checking in on them occasionally, like sometimes the state checks in on boys and girls who are in foster homes?
Oh, absolutely. We've got staff in place to manage the foster families. They have access 24/7 to our staff, to our clinic. So any veterinarian care that needs, we provide all the food, all the veterinarian care. Anything they need.
Wait, you guys provide all the food and all the care for a foster animal?
Absolutely.
Why do you do that?
It's because we would do it in the shelter. So it makes sense that we would do it in a foster home. You know, the only thing that we're not providing is that home environment. So, and essentially we are, because the foster family's stepping up.
Huh, that's interesting. I understand that this year saw a late kitten season, Kate. Can you explain that and what it means for the Humane Society shelters?
Absolutely. Again, it's, you know, I planned on kitten season April, May. It hit a little later. So when kitten season hits, that means that, and it's different, when a dog shows up at the shelter, it's a dog. When a kitten shows up at the shelter, it's got its brothers, its sisters, and its mom. So you're looking at 7 to 8 at a time. So we've done a very good job of putting foster families and programs into place so that it's like, let's call the next one. Hey, litter here. Can you come pick it up? And it's sometimes it's without the mom, so it's a bottle feeding situation. So that means somebody has to be ready to bottle feed 6 kittens every 2 hours.
How many volunteers do you have on hand to handle a responsibility like that?
You know, we've got about 30 foster families on the kitten side ready to go. And then we've got about 20 to 25 on the dog side. And again, we can always use more. It's endless.
I was going to say, how many could you use?
I'm not even going to put it. I'll take whatever I can get. I'll take 40. Good qualified candidates that are willing to put that time in. It's awesome for us.
Well, if someone is willing to foster a cat or a dog, what do you look for in a qualified candidate?
First of all, we're going to ask them, what do you feel comfortable in doing? You know, can you bottle feed kittens at 2 in the morning? Or, you know, are you comfortable with a medical case such as a dog with a broken leg or a dog with Demodex mange? Can you only do short term? So, you know, maybe it's 2 weeks before the dog is ready for adoption with that family, with the mm-hmm. future family. So it all depends, you know, and then, you know, how's your comfort level on dogs? What kind of dogs or cats or kids do you have in your home? I'm not going to take a dog that we've already cat tested. It doesn't like cats. I'm not going to put it in a home with a cat.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a lot of different individual things that we go through to figure out the right fit.
Yeah, yeah. Wayne Hunthausen, way in here, what would you advise for a family that might be listening to this conversation and thinking, hey, we'd like to help out here and become a foster family for a dog or a cat or a turtle or whatever? What should they be thinking about?
Well, do they have the time? What kind of space do they have? Do they have a safe place to keep the pet when they're out? Because some of these are going to be young pets. Maybe they've never lived in a home environment before.
Mm-hmm. Because you probably don't want to leave the house right away for a work day if you have a dog or cat a new dog or cat in the house.
Yeah, sometimes you just don't know what to expect from them, and some young dogs can be quite destructive. And so, it especially initially, if you have a family member that has some time or some time off from work to spend with that pet, that can be really helpful to get a little bit better idea on where the pet is at in regard to training.
Yeah. Kate, I'm guessing that most folks who might be inclined to want to be a foster family for a dog or cat are folks who already have a dog or a cat in the home. And you're saying that in some circumstances, you don't want to mess with that.
Well, it's all individual.
Right.
Family calls up, they want to be a foster. We talk to them. We go through everything that they have, all their situation at home, their time frame, just like Dr. Hunthausen said. We do meet and greets with the dogs, several of them. So if they have two dogs, we have one to place. We want to make sure that that's a good environment. You know, I'm respectful of the family, but also of the animals. So
mm-hmm.
if it's a stressful situation with the other two dogs, that's not going to happen.
Yeah. What are the big issues, Kate, facing the Humane Society of Greater Kansas City these days?
Well, you know, I'm always going to say funding. Always
yeah.
need funding. And, you know, our adoption shelter side is one thing. We do have a clinic that helps. It's a low-cost spay, neuter, and wellness clinic. So getting the word out to people who may not have the funding, they can get help. And so that's part of the education outreach, making sure people understand that is there for the whole entire Greater Kansas City area.
You know, Kate, there are plenty of opportunities to foster a dog or cat in Kansas City, even if it's just for a weekend. I noted that next month, KC Pet Project is having an event called Furlough, where 50 dogs will get a weekend out in the homes of 50 families who will show that dog what it means to be part of a family. To participate, go to kcpetproject.org. Do you know much about that program, Kate?
Just exactly what you mentioned, that it's a weekend out. That's awesome. I'd love to see it a week or 2 weeks. That'd be awesome.
Yeah, Wayne, can you figure
that
out...
That's a little more settling.
Yeah. Wayne, can you figure out in a weekend whether a dog or cat might be a good fit for a family, or is that not enough time?
Well, that's a pretty short period.
Yeah.
And you're more likely to find out things in that short period of time that in regard to the pet not working out, probably.
Yeah, the odds are against
yeah.
you. Eh?
Yeah. And yeah. so there are some things you could find out in that short period. But sometimes it takes a little while for for the pet to be with a family to get a real good idea of its temperament and how it does with family members, with other pets, with how it does on a leash, how it does with visitors and so forth. So yeah. A weekend's a pretty short period of time to really learn all that information.
And Wayne, again, two or three things you would do to your home to welcome a foster animal into it, you would focus on what?
Well, I'd want to think about an area where I'm going to keep the pet when I'm out of the home. So if there's if the pet's not crate trained, then I might want to have a spare room or some kind of area where I can safely keep the pet where it's not going to injure my house or injure itself or getting into trouble. So that one thing I wouldn't want to consider. Do I have any special commitments coming up that would interfere with the care I'm providing for the pet? Am I going to be home quite a bit? That would be all real important.
Yeah. Well, Kate Fields, President and CEO of the Humane Society of Greater Kansas City, thanks for all your good work and thanks for joining us today, Kate.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you so much.
You bet. Let me bring Jennifer Clare into our conversation now. She's head of rescue and adoption for Beacon Wings that looks to provide in-home care for birds in need of a temporary home until they're adopted. And Jennifer, thank you for taking some time. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity.
I'm guessing that there are maybe people like me in the audience who don't think of birds right away, at least when it comes to animals in need of finding a new home. What types of birds does Beacon Wings deal with, Jennifer?
Most of the birds that we have are parrots. We do have a few doves and finches and smaller birds like that. But for the most part, they are parrots, which is anything from your little parakeet to a large macaw or cockatoo. Those are all parrots.
Why so many parrots? Because they're a popular choice of a bird to bring into the home?
They are a popular choice, but they are extremely long-lived. Some of them can live 60 or 80 years. And so,
Whoa. Parrots live 60 or 80 years?
Yes. Obviously that's going to mean multiple homes. People are not as familiar with parrots, I think, as with dogs and cats. And so sometimes people just aren't prepared for the reality of living with a parrot. And after they've had it for a time, decided they just don't want to take care of it.
Wayne Hunhausen.
It can be a little difficult.
Give me a medical perspective here. I didn't know parrots live 60 or 80 years. They live as long as people.
They do. They do.
Why do they do that, Wayne?
Why do they do that?
What's that about?
They like and they love life. Sometimes, especially if you adopt a young parrot midlife, you got to think about maybe having it in your will, some preparation for care, once you're gone. Yeah, some of them will outlive their owners depending on what age you adopt.
Well, so Jennifer, if you take on a parrot into your home, this is a major commitment that you're making. Do people realize that when they buy a parrot?
Not always. I think it's the same with dogs and cats. Some people do a lot of research and have a good understanding what they're getting into. And sometimes it's an impulse and they really just don't have all the facts.
How do I go through my life in my 50s not knowing that parrots live that long, Wayne? What am I missing here?
You must be living a cloistered life.
I live a cloistered life, clearly. And Jennifer, how do parrots adapt to being moved from a home to another home? Maybe after they've been in a home for 15 or 20 years, how tough is that on the parrot?
It is tough. They obviously will go through stress and even grieving, but because they have such a strong instinct to be part of a flock, they will bond to a new owner also. So their instinct is telling them, I need to fit in with this new flock. And very often, they will bond with a new owner quite well.
How long does it take, Jennifer, for a parrot to bond with its owner?
I think that's very individual with the bird. But in general, you will start to see some bonding within a few months. And then as time goes on, that bond can even become stronger.
Mm-hmm.
So unless you have a bird that's really been in a bad situation before, may not bond as quickly.
But you're saying a few months, like two or three, then you can have a rapport with a parrot?
Oh, yes. I think you can start to have a rapport with a parrot in that length of time.
Yeah. Is there a frustration on your part when you deal with people who are giving up on parrot pets, for example, and you wonder if they should have taken the parrot on to begin with?
You know, sometimes. We have had the craziest thing of people who've actually decided not to keep a parrot because it didn't match the furniture. Now that's
really, really.
Yeah, yeah. And now that's a frustrating thing. But
and they'll admit that to you.
Yeah, yeah.
And what do you say to that?
In a situation like that, I think our best thing is just to remove the parrot from that home. Obviously, that's not a good reason to have a bird. And so in that case, it's probably best to just bite our tongues and say thank you. We'll be happy to rehome that bird.
Mm-hmm. And what's the demand for parrots that have been in one home and then are looking for a new home?
That's hard to say. Some people are believe that they would do better to have a baby bird, that a young bird will bond better.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually not necessarily true.
Huh.
The young baby birds, their instinct is to leave the nest of their parents. So if you have the bird as a baby and it sees you as a parent, as it matures, it does not necessarily bond to you better than if you had gotten it as an adult. So you also kind of can get over some of the terrible twos in the parrot world by adopting a little bit older bird.
Ah.
So sometimes there is a preference for baby birds, but because they're long-lived and people who know that also sometimes prefer a little bit older bird because then they're not having to have such a concern about what's going to happen when I can no longer take care of this bird.
Yeah. And I imagine if I come to Beacon Wings, I'm just guessing here, Jennifer, would the parrot that I would pick up there, that would be, I'm just guessing, considerably cheaper than getting one in a pet store.
That's true. We try to have our adoption fees about half to a third of what you would see from a breeder, and probably even less than that from a pet store.
What is that, can I ask?
Well, for example, a Moluccan cockatoo, which if you could even find one in this area for retail from a pet store would be probably $2,000.
Wow.
And we would adopt that bird for $600.
Wow. Okay. And what are the requirements for someone who might be willing to foster a bird, Jennifer? What are you looking for in a foster parent?
We are looking for responsible people that can provide a non-smoking environment, either no one smokes in the home or at least they smoke outside,
mm-hmm.
and is willing to bring that bird to our adoption events once or twice a month so that the public can meet the birds.
And why is that important?
Because that's really a better way to have them adopted than just seeing their picture on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
It actually to meet the bird and develop a connection with it.
Yeah.
And then we also, you know, some bird experience is nice, but it's not necessary. We have monthly education classes, and we'd be able to provide training for anyone who has not had experience with birds. We also provide the cages, because that can be a large expense, and quite a bit of the food.
Hmm. Okay.
If
someone agrees to foster a bird, Jennifer, how long might they expect to be with that bird once they take it in?
That can vary from a couple of months to over a year.
Hmm.
And, you know, certainly if someone has had a bird and does no longer wants to foster it, we would be able to move it. But it can take some time to find a home for a large parrot. Not everyone is equipped to take a bird that size.
Yeah, yeah. And how great is the need that you're facing right now for foster parents for birds of different kinds?
You know, it's a tremendous need. We turn away birds on a monthly basis because we don't have foster home space.
Wow.
And it's sad and it's scary because I don't know what becomes of those birds.
Hmm. Wayne, you know, I'm still stuck on the fact that parrots live 60 or 80 years. I thought raising teenage sons was difficult, but now I'm getting a new perspective on life here. You know, how often do you have someone come to you, Wayne, and says, hey, I'm interested in becoming a foster parent to a pet, or I've already done it, and I don't really know what I'm doing?
Well, I think the topic comes up maybe once or twice every month or two.
Yeah,
yeah, not real commonly, but it does come up. The interesting thing that I've learned here today is that for dogs and cats, risk factors for losing their home are often that they're destructive to the furniture, or they bite the kids or something. But for birds, redecorating might be a risk factor.
Yeah, I mean, no kidding. That just floors
something,
me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So if someone wants to get in touch with Beak and Birds, Jennifer, what can they do?
We have a website. It's www.beakandwings.org.
Mm-hmm.
And we also have a Facebook page. They can contact us there.
All right. And Jennifer, before you go, I just want to grab Wayne on one more thing. If you have an owner who comes in and tells you, Wayne, that they no longer can care for a pet, what advice do you give them? Do you try to talk them out of it? Do you not? What's the role, your role as head of an animal hospital?
Well, you want to try to if you sit down and investigate why they're making that decision. And sometimes there might be a behavior problem that they don't know how to address, but you might be able to give them some tips to address the problem and keep the pet in the home. So if there are issues that you can help the owner fix, then maybe they'll rethink their decision. But there's some situations where it's just not a good fit, either because of the environmental situation with the family or the pet's temperament. And in that case, it's sometimes the best thing for everybody is to find the pet another home.
Jennifer, we're talking about the downsides here. What are the upsides? What's the cool thing about owning a parrot?
The coolest thing about owning a parrot is the way they will bond to you. It is even more of an intense bond than with a dog or a cat. They mm-hmm. will literally love you unconditionally once that bond is there, and that's a great deal of fun.
How do parrots show love?
They show it. It a little bit depends on the species, but they will like physical contact, like their head scratched, like to sit near you or on you.
You can get them out of the cage and actually pet them and all that stuff.
Oh, yes, yes. They should have time out of the cage every single day. If they are not getting that time out, then they don't remain social. They can revert to their more wild instincts. So handling them every day is important.
Huh. I did not know that either. Well, Jennifer Kay, head of rescue and adoption for Beacon Wings, thanks so much for taking some time, Jennifer. I really appreciate it. We're visiting this hour with Dr. Wayne Hunhausen. He's a veterinarian and animal behavior specialist with the Westwood Animal Hospital. Joining us now is Connie Hendricks. She's president of the Operation Forget Me Not Horse Rescue and Sanctuary. That's located in Lynn Creek, Missouri, out in Camden County. And Connie, nice to have you. Good morning.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Connie, compared to dogs, cats, and birds, these animals are obviously huge. How difficult does that make finding people not just willing but, able to foster horses and ponies?
Well, we, of course, have people contact us that they don't want the responsibility of actually owning the horse, but they still want to have some contact with it, and they have the property and the desire to take care of one or two.
And like our previous foster organizations here, do you provide food for the horses if you foster them out there?
It depends on the situation. If the people are able and willing to take care of the horse on their own, that's great. If they need some financial assistance or grain or hay or whatever, yes, we do provide that. And any major medical problems, we would take care of ourselves.
And if someone's interested, Connie, how do they get involved with Forget Me Not Horse Rescue and Sanctuary? They want to become a foster parent to a horse. What do they have to do?
Well, they could go to our website and check us out and see exactly what we're trying to do. They can contact us through that. And fill out an application. We do have applications for foster homes. So we do check them out to make sure that, you know, the horse would be, horse or horses would be going to a good place. We would just like to have a personal one-on-one visit as well and check out where they are, what their property's like and all that. So
yeah.
Just to make sure the horse is in a good place.
So you actually check out the property before you'll allow someone into the program?
Either that or we get pictures. Usually we send people out to look. Obviously, there are areas and situations where we wouldn't want our horses to be. So we try to make sure that, you know, that they do have pasture and they have shelter and that they are in a safe environment.
How long is, just a couple final things, Connie, how long is the average stay for a horse who's being fostered?
Well, it can be quite lengthy. It can be as long as the people are willing to do. If they take a horse, usually it's a horse that's not adoptable. It cannot be ridden. It might have some physical problems where it just needs to have a pasture. As long as the people are enjoying it there and the horse is doing well, then it can be an unlimited time. If it's a horse that maybe is just out there to gain weight and just get into good health, when it is that way, then it would come back here. And we would have it trained or whatever and try to find it a permanent home. And if a foster home has them and maybe their situation changes and they can no longer do that, then they call us and we go get them, of course.
Horses are in your program. Why? Why are horses involved in Forget-Me-Not Horse Rescue?
Well, we've got a lot that are abuse or neglect cases. We've got several that are owner surrender. Maybe the people are older. They've had the horse for 20 years, and they're having to move in a retirement community or whatever, and they can no longer take care of the horse. They ask us to take it and make sure that it's safe. There's just the various reasons. We do get... we have bought some from kill auctions, you know, sale barns or whatever, and then get them back into shape and find them good homes. So
yeah.
It comes from a variety of places, but a lot of them are neglect.
Well, Connie Hendricks is president of Forget-Me-Not Horse Rescue and Sanctuary in Ling Creek, Missouri. And Connie, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for asking.
Wayne, how quickly will a horse, I know horses aren't your thing, but how quickly will a horse warm up to you in a situation like Connie's describing? What would you guess?
It's going to take the temperament, depend on the temperament of the animal. And if it's more of an anxious horse, they could take months or many months or more. If it's a horse that's been really well socialized, within a month or two, you can start seeing some bonding and some filiative behavior.
Yeah. We're going to turn the bulk of the show over now to Dr. Hunhausen. If you have questions about the finicky behavior of your cat, the doggedly determined behaviors of your dogs, give us a shout, 816-235-2888. Dr. Hunhausen visits periodically. His visits are always very popular with our listeners, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. You know, Wayne, we haven't talked about overweight pets for a while. Are we in the middle of an epidemic in this country, or what are you seeing coming into your practice on a day-in and day-out basis here?
Well, yes. If you look at the statistics across the country, there's an incredibly high number of obese and overweight pets. And when that happens, they have the same problems that we have. It puts stress on the heart, on the liver. It exacerbates arthritis problems, which are fairly common in large breed dogs. And decreases longevity of the pet too. So it's a serious problem.
And what do you advise pet owners when they come in with a dog or cat that's clearly very overweight?
Mm-hmm. Well, in some cases, there's a suggestion that the physical exams might suggest that there's an underlying hormonal problem. And diabetic pets are sometimes overweight and during a certain part of the disease. And hypothyroidism is real common in dogs. So dogs that tend to be lethargic, have a little bit of hair loss and overweight, those fit the profile of a dog that might be hypothyroid. And so we might want to run in some lab work and see if that's an underlying problem. The big issue, I think, with the weight loss, and because I'll have people come in and say, well, I just can't get the weight off my dog. And I'm trying to feed it less, and I don't give it very many treats anymore and it's still overweight, but they really don't have a good grasp on exactly what they feed every day or what the pet weighs from month to month. And so I think my advice in general is figure out what your pet eats. If it's eating ad lib, then we'll just measure the amount it eats every day for a few days of dry food, and then cut back the number of calories in its meals and in the number of treats you're giving by about 10%. That's not too bad. Most pets will tolerate that. And then give it more exercise, and very importantly, reweigh the pet in about 4 to 6 weeks. And if there's no significant weight loss, then reduce the amount of food fed by another 5 or 10%. And if you continue to do that every 6 weeks and decrease as necessary,
you'll have nothing left to eat.
Yeah,
you'll
be breathing
air,
but yeah, definitely going to lose weight. And that's probably the most important advice is, you know what the pet's intake is every day and get a good grasp on the weight on a regular basis.
What's the best way to weigh a dog or cat?
Well, if it's not too large, you can, or too small, you can pick up the pet and weigh yourself and the pet on a scale at home, and then weigh yourself and take the difference. You know, for real small pets, you really need a more accurate, maybe digital scale or a baby scale. And for large pets, veterinarians have scales that weigh pets that are up to 150, 200 pounds, and we encourage people to stop by and weigh their pets at our hospital if they can't weigh them at home.
I saw one stat that said 40% of pets in this country are overweight. 40%. That sound right to you?
That sounds right on the money from the numbers I've seen.
People want to feed their pet and be nice to it. There's too much of that going on, I'm guessing.
Yes. I think, you know, pets obviously love treats, and they get that tail wag going and that smile, and they're happy and they like it. And that makes us feel good because it makes us feel like we're doing something to make the pet happy. But and we don't look beyond the long-term effects. There was a study done here in the last year looking at what families can do if they have pets that have arthritis. And the number one thing, the recommendation that came out of that study was control the pet's weight. And if they do that, then some of these pets that are on anti-inflammatory medication or pain medication because they got some hip dysplasia, a lot of times you can cut back or remove that medication from the pet if they can get the weight to a normal weight.
Questions about your animal's behavior, your pet's behavior, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Shirley from Overland Park has a question about her adopted cat. Shirley, good morning.
Hi, how are you today?
Well, thanks, Shirley.
Well, my question is, we have a cat. We adopted her about 2 years ago, and everything's been fine, but all of a sudden, with her litter box, we haven't changed anything, but she still poops into the litter box, but when she pees, she started going on the floor in the basement. And I'm trying to see what type of thing we could do to try to fix that behavior.
The first thing I would do would be talk to your veterinarian about a physical exam and especially urinalysis. Because pets that have lower urinary tract disease typically have some type of discomfort when they urinate. And I think what happens is they assume that the discomfort has something to do with the box, and they try to avoid the box to avoid the pain. And so you see them urinating in other areas around home. So that's the first thing you want to do is rule out a medical problem. And if that's ruled out, then what you might want to do, if it's just in the basement, it's possible that you could clean up the urine odor down there and then maybe keep the pet out of the basement. And where are your litter boxes kept?
They're in the basement.
Okay. So yeah, the pet has
to.
Okay. A real simple thing you might try is clean up the urine odor. Use a really good product that's made specifically for that. And then most cats will eliminate where they eat or where their toys are kept or their scratching posts are kept. And so what you could do in that area where the pet's soiling is add a feeding station there. Maybe move a kitty condo or a scratching post there, leave toys there, do things, make changes in that area so the pet does behaviors that aren't compatible with urinating, and so the pet learns to keep that place clean. That may help you out.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right.
Good
Thank
luck, Shirley.
You. Appreciate your help.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Thank appreciate you. It. Bye-bye.
Okay.
Let's go to Mark from Shawnee. Mark, you're on with Dr. Wayne Hunhausen. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Well, thanks.
Hi, Mark.
Good. I have a 7-year-old Labrador, and he's otherwise healthy, but when we go to the dog park or we play real hard for a couple of days afterwards, he's limping, and I'm wondering if it's common to see that, and I feel like he's awfully young to have hip problems, but is that something you see in labs?
Is he lame in a front leg or a rear leg?
It's the rear, and it's I pushed around on it quite a bit, and I can't get any reaction from him, but yeah. It's the rear left leg.
Well, certainly hip dysplasia is very common in that breed and other large breeds, and so that would be something I would be suspicious of. And if you wanted to follow up on that, your veterinarian can take X-ray films of the hips and find out if indeed that you have some underlying hip dysplasia there. Hip dysplasia is basically a malformation of the joints. It causes the joint to be loose and the joint bones in the joint kind of bounce around and cause that discomfort, and the joint capsule gets stretched out and stressed. Or it could be something not related to that, knee problems, anterior cruciate ligament injuries are pretty common in large breed dogs. Those are the injuries that professional ball players often sustain. So it could be a problem in the knee. A good orthopedic exam is probably going to be the starting place to help this pet out. So your veterinarian can check out the different joints, make sure they're stable, there's no torn ligaments. As far as hip pain, sometimes you really have to extend and flex, really crank on that hip tell if there's actually some discomfort there. But that would give you a starting point, and then maybe some radiographs. And then what you might do is if this is real predictable, you might talk to your veterinarian about maybe a analgesic, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medication that you could give maybe when you come back from the exercise, prior to the exercise, or for a day or two afterwards, that would help the pet be more comfortable.
Okay. Is it okay to give a dog like naproxen or like a human anti-inflammatory, or is that bad for them?
Aspirin and buffered aspirin are safe medications given at the proper dose if you're not giving them too high doses for too long a period of time, in which case they thin the blood. The blood doesn't coagulate very well. Any of the other over-the-counter anti-inflammatory medications I'd stay away from. Advil, ibuprofen, any of those medications can cause some serious problems in dogs as well as in cats. But I wouldn't give anything without talking to your veterinarian first. There are some medications that you wouldn't want to give in conjunction with aspirin, and so you want to talk to your veterinarian before you start that.
Okay, thank you very
Thanks,
much.
Thanks, Mark. Good luck. Yeah, bye-bye. Let's go to Randy from Peculiar, Missouri. Randy, good morning.
Good morning. How are you guys?
Well, thanks, Randy.
Okay. My question is, my son told me that the frontline flea and tick stuff is not good around kids, and I got 13 grandchildren, and he suggested giving them garlic in their food bowl. So I've been doing that for about a month and a half. And it has worked well. You know what I mean? We don't have the front line or anything, and it's really worked well. And I was wondering, is the garlic bad for the dogs or not?
Well, there have been some studies where they looked at brewer's yeast and garlic and a few other products to prevent flea infestation, and the studies actually showed them to be non-effective. Small amounts of garlic aren't going to hurt the pet, but large amounts of raw garlic or raw onions can be very toxic. They have a toxic effect on the blood supply, and so you wouldn't want to give large amounts. So I don't. You may be just lucky, and maybe you're in an area this year that where the fleas aren't that bad. But
I'm right on the Grand River, and I mean we're in pick and flea country.
Yeah,
you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, so I just don't know about that.
Mm-hmm.
I just was worried about the garlic being bad for the dogs.
Yeah. How much garlic do you give every day?
I got two dogs, and they one's 110 pounds. Well, you're talking about an overweight dog. But it's what we call a mastador because it's half Labrador and half Mastiff.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you might want to talk to your veterinarian and go over the – discuss the weight and the amount that you're giving, and your veterinarian can give you a better idea on whether that's a problem or not. So best of luck to you.
Randy, thank you for the call. Wayne Hunhausen is a veterinarian and animal behavior specialist with the Westwood Animal Hospital. Wayne, you're always popular in here. Thanks for coming in and fielding all the calls and everything else.
Yeah.
Sure appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.